Welcome, everybody, to the Aris Meyer Podcast. How are you doing today? I am joined by a very special guest, a man that I have gotten to know virtually over the past couple months, and I'm really excited to talk to him. His name is Ankad. How you doing, my brother?
I'm good, man. It's funny, you call me Ankad. We were just saying before we started that you met my family, and the only people who call me that is my family, my biological family. And everyone else calls me Ankod. Like
Ankod. Oh.
Yes, but I can't tell you that you were wrong, because technically my family could speak before I could speak, and they were calling me that. I just didn't know it. I met them when I was 19, and then suddenly my name is, all this time Ankod. It was Ankod.
Your family's sounds also fishy, English, right? So it's like Ankod. Like it's like got a little
Ankod.
What is the origin of this name before we continue?
I was named by a spiritual leader that my biological and adoptive parents both believed in, and this was kind of the, part of the process of the adoption. It was done in a it was almost done in a kind of a religious ritualistic sense. It's officially it's called an offering child, and when I was adopted, they asked the leader, "Should we receive this child?" And the leader said, "Yes." It's a long story, but anyway, at the end of the day, it said, "You must receive this child, and his name will be," and then the leader wrote it on a piece of paper in English, AANCOD. My Japanese parents, my to-be adoptive parents, were very honored by that, said thank you, and that was the end of it. And I guess they just forgot the little tiny detail of, hey, by the way, what does the name mean?
Yeah.
So, no idea. I've looked it up, and there's no such thing as AANCOD. That's my name, and it has no meaning. I think that's the reason I still kept it.
It's funny because we're going to tell the people a little bit about your journey and about you, but it's funny because I feel like it encapsulates you so much, a name that has no meaning, that it, that is open to becoming. So the way that I first met you, we never officially met, but you have an Instagram account called Baby Steps Wiser, and I didn't know who you were. I saw the logo was a Zen circle. I believe it's called an Enso, and basically in Zen, it's when you turn your mind off and you draw a circle with your hand. That was the logo, so I was like, okay. And then I clicked on it and I watched, and it was you having conversations with people about religion, spirituality, and philosophy. And I was like, oh, this guy's very interesting, because the way that he's having this conversation is very like, not from a place of judgment, but from a place of openness and actual like conversation and dialogue. But yeah, that's how I got to know you.
Cool. So it's the symbol, I know it as Wu Wei. That's what it's called. Maybe your name is also accurate in a different language or whatever. Anyway, it's I understand it to be the symbol of the art of non-action or non-forcing, of just go. It kind of like the judo way, just, you know, use whatever is given to you and use the force of life as it comes to get energy from it, and use that as your force rather than trying to move something in a direction that it's not trying to go. Or let's say, you know, when you cut wood, don't cut against the grain, cut it along the grain. Like if there's the lines, cut along that grain. I guess that's what it means. Whatever. Anyway.
Yeah. But yeah, so you were having these conversations with people, and I thought they were very cool. They were very open. You're having conversations with people that you didn't agree with, that you were very specifically not in agreement with. And I thought that was very cool in a time where everyone just cancels each other and doesn't talk to each other and is so stubborn, you know.
Off as upset?
No. You were very. What I liked about it was you were very like straightforward with them. When somebody would start talking to you and it was not logical or it was like just pure opinion, you were like, "Well, hold on," you know. And I appreciated that kind of conversation where it was like, "Let's talk about things factually as they are," instead of like the theoretical, this is how I feel conversations. But anyway, I appreciated that about you. So that's the first time I saw you. And then I started, you know, following your social media and kind of trying to figure out who is this guy, you know, like what's going on? He's a very white looking guy, and digging through your stuff on YouTube. And I was like, he's in Korea. And then I started watching your videos and like, he speaks like perfect Korean. This is so bizarre. Who is this man? So yeah, if you can take us a little bit through your journey, how you got to Korea, why you're like, it's just so confusing.
I don't know where to begin, man. How I got to Korea. Well, Korea's, I mean, it might, the way I tell the story might raise too many questions. So I don't know if it's going to be super informative. But basically, I was raised in Korea when I was a teenager. I grew up here when I was, 12, between 12 to about 18 or something like this. I went to regular Korean school and, you know, I went to an international school to kind of learn the Korean language and other things that they taught me there, which were very religious, if you will. Mm. And before you know it, I was just living on my own in Korea. At the age of 16 or 17, I decided to leave that whole establishment, leave that entire crew of people, in a sense, and the faith and all the religious stuff that came with it. I put it all behind, not so much to reject it, but just to get space from it so I can figure out if it's right for me. Because when you're in the bubble of that kind of influence, when everybody thinks and believes the same thing, and they're not on the same page as you, as wanting to question the entire thing, and your questions are either neglected or considered uninteresting or even offensive, you're in the wrong room. So I basically left that establishment, lived in a little tiny room. It's called a Koshiwon in Korea. The size of the room is the size of the bed. There's not even space to do push-ups or anything. It's just you can stand, and then once you lie down, your feet hit the wall right away. And above your feet is the desk, and above the desk is a TV, and next to it is a little fridge. And it's tiny, and the walls are really thin, and it's for students. And I lived there from 16-ish, and absolutely loved it. Got my independence, and then continued living in Korea. I left Korean school because I also felt like that environment was crap, and I'm very open about hating Korean middle school. Mm-hmm. And then, at some point I realized, oh, that's right. I have a biological family somewhere. As we mentioned, I was adopted by a Japanese family. My biological family somewhere hanging out, and I'm going to meet them some point in my life, and might as well do it right away. Let's just get it out the way. And so I left Korea and went to see them, and that started a whole new journey. Maybe about 7 years later or so, came back to Korea, performed in the subway, because this is what I was doing at the time, being a musician. And one of the videos of me performing was caught on someone's phone, uploaded on YouTube. Before I knew it, within 24 hours, there was over 1 million views, and every major TV station was calling me, wanting to interview me or have me on their program. And it was a bit overwhelming, but established myself here as some kind of a character. And then at first I hated all the fame and the pictures and stuff, and so I ran away to Thailand. I lived there for quite a bit on an island, secluded, half naked, 24/7, just, you know, having a good time. And then slowly but surely Korea kept calling me back somehow, with friends getting married or whatever, and job offers. And then I actually started to have a lot of fun performing in Korea and building big concerts, built a fan base for people who really liked my own songs. And it was no longer about the, oh, white guy speaks Korean, wah, you know. And I didn't plan Korea to become a base, but eventually did. And now I'm a radio DJ, and it's an everyday thing. And so I can't go anywhere. And especially because of COVID, I can't go anywhere either. So I've been here for like 2-3 years straight now.
Wow.
Hope that summarizes it somehow.
Yeah. I mean, that's a pretty good summary. So this song that you were singing, was it your own original song, or was it a cover of a song? Or
right. So when I performed on the streets in Korea at that time, it was like a 2-3 week period, I wouldn't speak in Korean to the audience, and I wouldn't do any of that, because it shifts the mood from the oh, here's a musician performing music and I'm having a good time, to yo, this guy's Korean, so cool, I want to hear him speak more of it. And the focus shifts, and I didn't like that. So I wouldn't sing Korean songs unless at the very end, after they've stayed for my entire, you know, performance, however long it was, I felt the kind of warmness with the crowd. And it's like, you know, you get it just you just feel like, oh, you know, they stayed till the very end. And you know what? Yeah. Let me give you a kind of like a gimmicky song just to end it off, just to give you a little surprise.
Yeah.
And so I'm sometimes, not too often, would end it with the Korean song, like a surprise. This whole time I could speak Korean, and it's like the Korean song is like a rap, and so there's a lot of lyrics. Blah 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 blah. I memorized it when I was 12, like back in international school, and so it just comes to me without even thinking about it. My mouth just does it, and so I do that, and people go, oh my god, and then for the chorus I go, you guys sing it, and then they sing the chorus because they know the song. Mm-hmm. And there's this whole, you know, me playing for them and them singing, which is very warm and reminiscent of those kind of churchy days that I used to play guitar for church and everybody used to sing, you know.
Yeah
And I loved that. I loved that that role that I played as the guitarist for the church, and everyone sang. So I have a strong connection with that, and so I would do that. And suddenly one time somebody took a video and uploaded it, and I was that night, I was together with a friend from Australia, really cool guy, who was also a busker in his own way, we were like, that night, so randomly said, hey, let's go to Busan, which is a southern city of Korea. We were in Seoul at the time. Let's go to Busan. Yeah, let's do it. And just out of the blue, we got on the bus in the middle of the night and arrived in Busan in the morning, completely tired and knocked out. And our plan was like, let's get a house here and just see if we can live here. You know, there's no plans. We're just kind of nomadic. That was kind of our lifestyle at the time. We arrived in Busan so tired. We're like, we're too tired to go looking for homes right now. So let's just sleep somewhere. Like, there's a beach. Let's just fall asleep on the beach. And so we put our bags on the beach and like set up some towels, and we just like slept on the beach. And then I get a call at like 3 or 4 PM from a friend of mine. He's like, oh, hey, what's up? He's like, oh, hey, uncle. He's like, yeah, long time no see. How you been? He's like, dude, SBS wants to talk to you. I'm like, SBS? It's like, yeah, the TV channel. I'm like, why? He goes, oh, you don't know? You didn't check the internet? I'm like, no, my phone is a folder phone. I don't have internet on my phone. I'm way behind. I'm still always behind it. It's like, dude, it's fire online right now. You got to go check it out. And I'm like, what's going on? It's like, dude, your video of you singing is ever. I'm like, oh, whatever. So can I give them your number? Can I give SBS your number? Because they contacted me because they saw I'm your friend on Facebook. Yeah, sure. Give it to them. And at the time, I don't know why I didn't think much of it. I went back to sleep. In the beach. I was tired, man. And my friend's sleeping next to me. I'm going to wake him up. Just, what am I going to do? Just go back to sleep. Wake up 30 minutes to an hour later. Another call from the same friend. Dude, KBS just called me. They want you on the show too. And like this, 2, 3, 4 different channels suddenly wanted to get in touch with me. And then I was like, oh, something's going on for real. Anyway, we just got to carry on. We woke up, got some food, went looking for homes. And that night I was going to go busking in the subway in Busan train station. And usually this is what happens. I set up, I get my guitar, and I open my guitar bag, and how can I say? I put at least $1 or $2 in there to show that this is a tip box.
Yeah, classic and busking
then I
move.
Kind of set up, and the whole. Yeah. And usually by the time I do that and I look up, all the people who've noticed in the subway are just like, oh man, this guy, some random homeless looking dude with hippie dreadlocks is gonna fucking sing now. Oh shit. And so they all turn their backs on me and they wait for their train, right?
Yeah.
That's usually the move. And I love that because I would start singing, and within a minute and a half, 2 minutes, by the end of the first song, I would have them all turn towards me, clapping and putting money in my thing. And I love that twist. I love that. I enjoyed that a lot.
Yeah.
So when people would turn their back on me, I'm like, oh yeah, you wait. Okay. You know, and this was my vibe. However, this time in Busan, after the whole TV station called and everything, my first bus, I'm setting up and I lift my head up expecting everybody to, you know, give me dirty looks. But no, they're all looking at me and they're ready with their phones.
Oh my God, dude.
They're all pointing their phones at me. And I'm like, whoa, Busan is different. I'm thinking. And I did the gig at normal, nothing, you know, out of the ordinary. Finished, got the usual amount of tips. Everything was regular. And at the end, one person comes up to me and they're like, is this you? And then they show me a video of me online. And this was just about 24 hours prior in Seoul, in the subway. And there's like 1 point something million views on there. And I'm like, holy shit, this is what this is about, the TV stations and everything. And so as soon as I realized this, I packed up. I called my friend, my Australian friend, who was busking on the beach somewhere. And I was like, dude, I think I'm famous. And he's like, yeah, whatever, man. You know, forget it. You're not famous. What are you talking about? I was like, no, really. He's like, yeah, whatever. And I hang up. And we get there and he meets me at the subway station and we're walking. And I'm telling him, dude, I think this thing is real. The TV station's calling and everything. It all makes sense. I guess this video went viral. He goes, yeah, whatever, man. It's not a real thing. Okay. I was like, okay, let me show you. Let me see if I make eye contact with anybody. And we're walking down Busan, a busy street, and I make eye contact with somebody and they see me holding the guitar, hippie guy. It's like, and they look at me and they start to talk to each other, pointing at me. One person comes over. He's like, are you this guy? I'm like, yep. He's like, can I take a picture with you? And he takes a picture with me. And then suddenly everybody else on the street realizes what's going on. They're like, that's the guy. I want a picture with him too. And then everyone's queuing up to take a picture. And like people gather around taking pictures. And I'm looking at my friend. I'm like, fuck, you see this shit? He goes, holy shit, you are famous. You know? And, you know, we went and had another busk there and went busking and stuff. And it was pretty normal at first. But very quickly, it turned into something I didn't enjoy at all because everyone just wanted to hear me sing a Korean song. And it was no longer pure. And just within a few days, I got really sick of it. Really sick of it. I want people to have no expectation of me. I want people to think I'm a dirty street performer. And then by the end of the show, like, come up to me and give me a hug and say, you really moved me, or, you know, you've made my day, or no, that's what this is about. That's the flavor that I was looking for. But this time it's them with the phones.
Yeah.
Waiting. Oh, it's not the Korean song yet. Okay. Put the phone down.
Yeah. Everyone wants to be involved in the moment somehow. They want their themselves to be part of that, like that thing that's happening. They want to ride the wave. I feel like that's why it's such a thing. There's so many cool videos, and I wonder if these people had an experience like you. Like, there's this one guy, he's busking and he's playing Pink Floyd's Time, and he's in Rome, it's just like, it made me cry the first time I ever saw it. There's this so many videos of exactly what you're talking about. This thing that you bring out of people, and it moves me too. There's another one of this guy, and he's in New York, and he starts playing This Is a Man's World, James Brown. And it's just like you said, nobody's looking at the guy. And then he starts playing and then he starts singing and you just see everybody like turn, like the air changes. You know what I mean? But yeah,
that's the magic, man.
When did you start busking? When did this become a thing for you of wanting to busk?
Well, we're skipping through points in history here, I guess, but I played music, like I mentioned, even when I was a kid. I played guitar, you know, and as soon as I learned how to play guitar, I was living in Israel at the time. I just took a few lessons and quickly moved to Korea International School. And that's when guitar became a thing. I was playing it all the time for church. And every month or two, we'd have these big birthday parties. And so I would make performances with friends. And that was a thing. So it was something that I loved, but I maybe dreamt of becoming a musician, but quickly through this, you know, struggle of depression and whatever, of leaving a religious institution mentally and, you know, meeting my family, identity crisis, I dropped the whole thing and I wanted to go be homeless somewhere so I can die but stay alive. And I dropped music for a few years from then on, from the being homeless part. And then after a few years of looking for meaning and purpose of life, there was a moment where it was just like a bah, right? And I can't say it was just in a single moment, but it led. It was building up. And then bah. And the buildup was more of like a shedding of layers of my identity, shedding layers of my past traumas, shedding layers of fears, limiting beliefs. And it was really quick. It happened within a few months, shedding. And the more I shed, I felt more present in the very moment and fearless. And I was doing this shedding deliberately through an actual meditation technique that I became obsessed with at the time. And I meditated every day. And every time I meditated, it was like life became upgraded. It was just like a fix of a drug that instead of You know, in drugs, it's kind of the opposite way, where you constantly, they say, chasing the dragon, where you want to get that high, but you can't get it back. It was the opposite. Each time I went into meditation and came out, I was happier than 3 hours prior.
Oh, wow.
And so the more I meditated, my happiness got higher and higher and higher, because I got really good at shedding layers, and I got more and more efficient at it and very focused. And so at some point it shed to almost nothing, where I felt like Encode is completely dead. There's no more Encode. There's no more identity. I'm done. I'm free. And then all these years of like, what should I do with my life? You know, like, you know, everyone tells me I have potential. You know, that being a musician doesn't make money. And what if it doesn't work? Or what if I get famous? I don't want to be famous, because, you know, it comes with all this kind of, I don't know what to do. All these worries, it all just kind of blah, evaporated. And I was like, you know what? What do I want to do today? That's all I care about. What do I want to do today? Let's just go with that technique. Today, I feel like I want to sing. I want to travel the world. And I'm going to get dreadlocks. Those are the three things that I was clear about. I didn't know why, but it came as a gut feeling. And immediately, I booked my next gig. And I got my first dread on that same day. And that was it. Ever since that moment, I've only been funding my life with music, mostly. I mean, 99%, you know.
Would you say so you're obviously you're talking about kind of ego death and shedding your old life. I'm assuming it's a lot of like the church programming, you know, you have to have a family, you have to, you know, the way that we were raised, there's very specific things that you were supposed to do, or else you were literally an out and out failure. So I'm assuming you felt a lot of that pressure. But when you were meditating, what did you find was the most efficient way to lose ego, to shed? Was it a specific technique of meditation? Was it breath work? Was it, you know, like what to you made it so, you know, some people change their life by being baptized. Some people change their life by moving to a place where they don't know anyone. And, you know, there's so many different ways people change their lives and try to heal themselves. Some people go to a therapist, whatever it is. Some people escape with, you know, cigarettes and TV and fast food. Everyone has their way of trying to change who they are or become. How did this meditation help you in such a transformative way?
Right. You mentioned a very strong point about programming from childhood about this, you know, religious stuff. And I have to say that it wasn't that anymore. For me, that was while I was homeless, and that period, by that time, I was already done with that. And it felt like something that I graduated from and didn't care about anymore. My depression prior to that wasn't about the church so much. I'm sure it had some kind of influence, but it wasn't the programming of a religious institution. It was the programming of the world today. The whole entire world, in a way, is very similar to a religious institution, as we have this superstitious belief that we, as identities, that our identities are real, and that and not only that we are extremely somehow important or serious, and that we have to go against the world, and, you know, it's poor little me inside this world, and I have to find a way to find joy in it. And, you know, when you ask somebody, hey, who are you, you know, and they'll be like, well, I'm you know, Michael Smith or what have you, I'm a teacher, or this is what I do. And it's like, yeah, but that's kind of a very, very superficial way of seeing existence, I think. And the technique I used was Vipassana meditation. I used to be obsessed with this technique, but quickly realized it's not about the technique. You can do it, like you said, in many different ways. So the one that worked for me was Vipassana meditation, where all these ideas of me uncode experiencing life as a let's say spotlight of consciousness, looking at reality and choosing what to pay attention to and what it means, and then deciding what to do with it. That's what we do every moment, right? We make three decisions every moment, whether we like it or not, subconsciously or consciously. paying attention to, I mean, there's a million things happening right now as we mm-hmm. speak. Yeah, we can pay, we choose what to pay attention to, and then we're kind of giving it a meaning inside our own hands. We'd say, oh, this is good or bad or funny or sad, whatever. We have a meaning, and then we're going to decide to keep doing what we're doing or change it or to, you know, take action or not. So I felt like that was it. That was what life was about, this spotlight consciousness of on-code experiencing the world. But through this Vipassana technique, I started to experience a level of consciousness that felt like, instead of like having being a spotlight, it was almost like floodlights, where I just saw everything just happening. Everything was just happening. So I would, yes, pay attention to specific things that were happening, but I wouldn't do the second thing, which is decide what it means. I would no longer give things a meaning. I would just see things as they are. Right? We said before, you pay attention to something, you decide what it means, then you decide what to do. I skipped step two and three. I just watched it, and I was able to stay in that state for, you know, an hour, sometimes two at a time, through discipline. I'm not saying it's the only way, but it worked for me. And when I'm in that state, it's very easy to see or experience all feelings and thoughts happening inside this body, just like the wind is blowing outside. So it's no longer my feelings and my body and me. Just like you don't look at that wind, it's called my wind. You don't do that. So it was all just one thing happening as a phenomenon, almost like watching a movie. And it was very easy to look at it objectively without deciding if what I'm feeling is good or bad, or you know, mentally disabling, or is this a trauma experience from my past, or all this yada yada. It just all became blah, and it all melted away, and I just watched it happen. And I watched how this phenomenon of all emotions are impermanent. We know this, but they become rapidly evaporating if we don't give them any attention. Like if we don't feed them. So I would feel pains or whatever that from childhood, whatever. And I would feel it in my body, not in my head, like, oh yeah, my mom said this to me once, or, you know, I remember that teacher. Da, 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 da. It wouldn't be this. I'd just be like, oh, look, oh, I feel like a chest pain. It's wow. You know, and I watch it, and sure, it's something that I recognize that I'm supposed to dislike and feel is uncomfortable. But in that state, there's no such thing as uncomfortable or bad or good. You're just watching it equanimously. There's just complete equanimity. Just watch it happen. And when I'm able to watch that thing happen as it comes up, it very quickly becomes, oh, wow, that's really painful. Oh, that's painful. Oh, interesting. Oh, that's painful. Oh, wow, it's getting smaller. Oh, whoa. Oh, I can see it going away. Interesting. Okay, oh, it's gone. All right. Well, there it is. Okay, well, that's gone. And once that's gone, it's just like a fire that has been burning inside of me, or a pile of coals that has just been lit in fire. And normally my reaction would be, oh, yeah, you know, I remember, you know, I was treated so horribly, or I was brainwashed, whatever. And resentment comes over. And each time I think a thought that triggers that even more, it's like putting wood into that fire, and the fire would grow more inside of me, and the coals would stay hot. And people live with that for years, decades, sometimes a whole life. Mm-hmm. But in this particular case, it was like watching that fire just burn and burn and burn. And the coal would keep burning up and burning up. And I'm not giving it any wood. I'm like watching it. And it's, you know, quote unquote, painful, but it wasn't suffering. It wasn't disturbing. This pain was simply information. And after a while, the fire gets dimmer and dimmer and dimmer and dimmer, and it has nothing to burn anymore. And it's done what it wants. Feelings just want to be felt, right? And we push them back, so we carry them with us, and it numbs our life. But once I allowed all my feelings that I was carrying within me to just be felt and come out and within my body and just kind of express themselves like a flower that blooms and then naturally dies. Once it was gone, I could think about those thoughts again, the resentment, whatever, like putting wood on it. But this time there was no flame for the wood to catch fire on. And what happened then is, naturally, because there was no emotional stimulation to these thoughts anymore, it didn't trigger anger or resentment or even joy, that the brain simply just gets bored of it. So you just stop thinking about it. And so I quickly kind of shed all these things, and the whole struggle of teenage life, identity crisis, programming, brainwashing, oh, this religion did this to me, blah, 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 that very quickly became so if you may, boring to me. All of my traumas of, you know, my parents raising me wrong or whatever, all this stuff, you know, whatever. It's just boring. It's not real anymore. It didn't feel like it was me anymore. It was just all that coal was gone. And I might still have some coals in me left over, but they haven't come up in any way. And I'm trying to be careful to people don't take this wrong when they hear this, but by my own standards of what you might call depression, compared to what I've experienced up until that age, I've not been depressed for the past 9 years.
That's powerful, man.
I just can't get depressed. It feels like it wouldn't work. Depression can't play its trick on me anymore. Because I know, it's like you watch it and you're like, hey, I know. It's like a magician with a magic trick. And you're like, I know how you do that.
Yeah.
I know how you're trying to make me depressed. Like, I can see right through you. So I'm not impressed, you know?
Yeah. That's interesting. So a lot of people you tell me, a lot of people draw from these emotions and these experiences to create art, right? Whether it's happy or sad or beautiful or whatever it is. Did you feel like after you had this experience with this meditation that it was harder for you to create, or like almost like the walls were gone so you could, you were, you know, God was speaking through the back of your head and just coming out of your mouth, you know? Like how did you feel like it was to create music after this experience?
That's a really good question. It's a really lovely question. Both. So you said either it was harder to express or you became more fluid. I think it became both, because I had less to draw from my past, because I couldn't relate to the old suffering encode anymore in the same way that I used to. Mm-hmm. Whereas before, anything would trigger that and I'd be like, oh yes, and this reminds me of, you know, whatever, you know, my friends who betrayed me or who outcasted me and made me feel lonely, or, you know, my parents who said this to me and made me feel abandoned or didn't understand me, or, you know, my first love who, you know, broke my heart because of their parents, you know, whatever. Like, it was very easy to get triggered about that and write, and it would come up. But at this point, those thoughts were so boring. Mm-hmm. And sorry to use the word boring, that most...
Yeah, speak your truth, man. Talk your shit.
I think it's the most accurate word. I was bored of all of that. That just was so beyond me that I couldn't draw from that anymore. So when I made music, I would have to do it right there and then on the spot, whatever I was feeling now.
Hmm.
And when I was performing, I could only perform songs that I felt now, right? So I could flirt with emotions. Like I can play a sad song to see if I can fall into it. And then once I fall into it, I can sing it and express it. And I can feel that I'm giving it to the audience. But sometimes people would request a song and I would play it and I'd be like, I just don't feel it. And I would notice that the audience doesn't feel it either. And so when it comes to music and creation, it became more of a play of energy. And so if I could feel something, I could express it. But I could no longer play old songs that I wrote and expect the audience to feel it, because I no longer felt it. And so those songs also became boring to me. So yes, I could no longer bring out stuff, but at the same time, people kind of confuse this idea of detachment with lack of participation. It's the opposite. Yeah.
You sound so much like, I'm a very big fan of Ram Dass, who recently passed away. I read his books and then I would watch him speak.
He passed away.
Yeah. Ram Dass passed away. I think it was last year in Hawaii. What you're saying is so close to what he was saying, the beauty of the moment, just being a conduit to the world around you, whether it was happiness or sadness or whatever it was. And just the beauty of that very present moment, whether you were the saddest you've ever been or the happiest you've ever been, just feeling that feeling. I definitely can see the similarity.
It's very difficult to talk about, because the more you talk about it, the more you feel like you're escaping it, because you could interpret words in so many different ways at different angles, that each time you say something, as soon as you say it or even before you say it, you can see the 15 different ways of interpreting what you just said. And then you have to start eliminating all the other interpretations, like, no, but I said this, but I didn't mean that, or that, but I mean that. And as soon as you say that, you've also created a bunch of other fruits of different interpretations. And so, you know, I'm trying to be careful of talking about it, but you know, I'm a Zaccarelli. And so I love talking. And so I end up talking too much. I think the best way to say what you just said, and in addition, there's no more resistance to what's happening now. You're no longer resisting it. So if it's good or bad or whatever, you completely get with it. Completely get with it. So it's not a kind of a detachment. A lot of people confuse that, like, you'll meditate into equanimity, and you know, that's like being numb to the world. I'd rather feel the sadness and happiness of life. I don't want to be, you know, detached from the world like all these monks. That's a completely misunderstood interpretation. It's the opposite. You are completely participating in it. Completely. When you feel sad, you feel even more sad than you would have before. When you feel happy, more happy than it would have before. However, it doesn't shake your core, because I don't want to get all woo-woo, but because you know now that there is no such thing as a core. There's no core. There is no ego. It's an illusion. And so it's like trying to catch water, you know, with your hand. You do it as much as you can, but you can't. You'll feel wet, but it won't. You know, when you realize there's nothing to let go, then you stop trying to hold on, you know?
Damn. All right, and the last piece of what you said that we definitely got to touch on. It's a stereotype. The white guy with dreadlocks, man. It's a thing, you know what I mean? Of course, I think a lot of white people were influenced by Bob Marley, Rastafarianism, but we know that it also dates back further than that, depending on your culture. Why did you choose specifically, like, what spoke to you about dreadlocks? What made you feel like, man, this is part of the new Encode becoming? You know what I mean? Because when you set it up, it was very specifically in there, you know? The king is crowned. Yeah, they put the crown on his head, you know? It's part of the ceremony. So I feel like it was in there somewhere.
Well, first of all, I have to say I knew nothing about Rastafarianism or Bob Marley when I first got dreads. I never even liked Bob Marley music. I was like, why is this guy so popular? And I felt the same way about a lot of legendary musicians. I just didn't get it. I had my own niche music that I liked, and I didn't care about the rest. Bob Marley was a name that I knew. But I have to say that I would have gone through the same thought process before that period I explained to you about, like, shedding and kind of, you know, kind of this experience of liberation, whatever you want to call it. Before that, if you asked me 6 months prior to that moment, if I want dreads, my whole mind would go, okay, what do dreads mean? How does society perceive dreads? Where does it come from? I would be a white guy with dreads. How is that going to make me look like? What are people going to think? How am I going to explain it to people? How can I justify getting dreads? I need a story. That would have been my normal thought process. But at that moment, there was nothing. I didn't give a fuck. I just thought, let's just get some dreads. And that was it. There was not a second thought to it. I didn't care. Of course, I realized that people might think stuff, but that idea, what might people think? That question was boring enough that I didn't spend any time on it.
Yeah. That completely speaks to what we've been talking about the last, you know, 20 minutes. This like complete freedom of ego death. That's crazy, man. So you traveled, you had this profound experience, and then, you came back to Korea and you had this experience of being filmed. And then how did you get away from that feeling? Like, it sounds like you got famous and you were like, fuck, I don't want to be famous. I just want to create, but you're still in Korea. I mean, yeah, you know what I mean? That it must follow you.
So, first of all, I appreciate your effort in trying to articulate questions in the right time and right place. I understand that it's not easy with my story right now because it's all scattered. It's hard to know where to go with it. Yeah, you're doing great. You're doing great. Great job, man. Kudos. I want to answer that by saying there was a huge period between that moment I decided to, you know, do whatever I want, play music or whatever, and then the moment I came back to Korea and this whole like fame experience. I traveled for about 5 or 6 years or 7 years with that mindset. As soon as I got that one dread, I slowly added dreads along the way. At the time, I was dating a wonderful girl, and she made me a dread every movie we watched. She would do one dread while we watched a movie. And
oh, that's cool.
Slowly but surely, I got all these dreads, and she did them all. And I think she did them all, yeah. And then, basically, the whole mindset was, and this is going to come back full circle to answer your question, the whole mindset at the time wasn't, I'm going to be a traveler musician with dreads. That wasn't it. There was nothing like that. There was not so much interest in the idea of what I'm going to become. I didn't care. All I did was feel what's happening right now, and everything was like a mushroom trip, and everyone, wow, 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 wow. Everything was just, you know, so exotic. All the colors would pop out at me, and knowing that I'm, you know, I didn't take any drugs. I'd just been drinking water, not even drinking alcohol, and everything is so vibrant, and I can really see people, and I can know from my own gut feeling which person on the street I'm going to vibe with and who I'm not. Everybody has that gut feeling, but this was all enhanced in such a big way that moment to moment, whatever I did, whatever song I heard, whatever, everything was like I was a child in a playground. Every moment was so exciting, you know, and oh, what's next? You know, like, ooh, you know what would be really cool? South Africa, let's do it. You know, and so I just went to South Africa, like with no money, no plans or anything. And so, you know, I would, at the time I was, let's say I was in Portugal. I did a road trip with a few of my friends. We got in a car, and we traveled all of Portugal, and we played together on streets, on beaches. We had a tent, and we slept on the beach all the time. We just traveled from city to city and played, and it was a beautiful country, Portugal. I was doing this, and we were reaching towards the end of our journey, and was in a hostel, and I just sat in front of the hostel computer, the public computers, and I opened on Google the world map, and I just stared at that map for like 2 hours, you know, with music in my ears. And I was just like, where do I feel like going next? You know, and just a gut feeling for South Africa popped up. So I was like, okay, let's go to South Africa. There wasn't I should go to South Africa because it's just like South Africa. It's okay, done. And so immediately, okay, what is the flight to go to South Africa? What's the price? Cool. What's the visa requirements? Cool. You know, the technical stuff.
Were you busking the whole time to make money?
Always, 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 always with between $30 to $100 or euros, if you will, in my pocket. And that's all I ever had at one time. Just enough for a place to sleep and then travel a little bit and then busk again the next day and make some money. So, but if I had to save up money because I would plan to go to another country, in this particular case, South Africa, I would naturally, and it's funny because I find this hilarious because I was never even taught this. Maybe I was taught this, but I wasn't doing this in a deliberate, disciplined way, but I would just visualize myself in South Africa and imagine what it would feel like. And I would imagine getting on the plane on the way to South Africa, and I would feel those feelings and get all excited while looking at this world map. You know, it was already happening inside of me, like, oh yeah, cool. And by that time it felt like it was already done. It was a matter of time for it to happen. And so of course, I think, okay, well, how much is the flight? And then, okay, if the flight is say $500-$600, one way, I need to busk for this many days and save up this much money so I can buy this ticket on this date, whatever. I'd make a kind of a rough plan. And very quickly, and as this happens, and I'm sure you have experienced it, a lot of us have these moments, something would just happen where everything would fall into place in a way that I wouldn't expect at all, but would no longer surprise me. So in this particular case with the South Africa one, we were playing a gig in the hostel that we're staying in. By the way, that's how we slept in hostels for free. We'd say, can we stay here and we'll do a gig at night for your customers, for your, you know, clients, and just give us a bed. And that's how we didn't spend money on. So we did the gig. And then of course, after the gig, you know, we all drank together, and one Polish dude, and I don't remember his name at all because I never saw him since, but I think I mentioned South Africa as my next destination or whatever. He goes, oh, yeah? Well, there is this Polish airline that's doing this huge sale on prices to Johannesburg. And I was like, oh, yeah? But I'm like, no, but I know because I go to Skyscanner and they show all the sales and I didn't see that. He goes, no, no, you can't find this on Skyscanner. You have to go to this link and click this. It's all in Polish. So he showed me this Polish website who was just going doing this thing. And so the price from being 650 euros or something was suddenly 180 euros. So the price dropped that moment. So I had that money. So I was like, okay, cool. Can I give you the cash and can you buy me the... And there we go. I had a flight to South Africa that night.
That's insane. Is there a large group of people that do this kind of thing that you're talking about? I know that like a lot of cultures, like in England, for example, they'll take like a year off after school and travel the world, or they'll go, you know, different places. Did you feel like when you were traveling all over, there was a lot of people in hostels that were doing what you were doing, kind of experiencing the world? Like, is that like a subculture?
Yes, but everyone had money.
Yeah, that's the big difference.
And so people would want to do all the tourist stuff that was super expensive. And I never, you know, like when I was traveling, like I said, it was a few years, but if I really traveled the way people travel for 6-7 years, I think I would have gone to a lot more countries. I wasn't interested in that. I just wanted to live in countries. So somebody corrected me once, said, you didn't travel, you moved around. And I was like, okay, that's the better expression. I moved around because I wanted to live there and experience what it's like to busk there. How much money can I make there? And with that money, what can I do? And so I haven't done any of the touristy stuff in all these countries. People, oh, well, you've never been to Sydney if you didn't go on that bridge. I'm like, what bridge? You know, I don't care. I was in Sydney. I was jamming with all the Sydney musicians. I got into this, like, you know, private club where everyone, and I was invited. Like, to me, that's experiencing the city. And so, I can say that I met a lot of other people that traveled like me and like on their gap year, it's called in England.
Oh, gap year. Yeah. Sorry.
Took a year or two off to travel, but they were loaded, bro. Most of the time, you know, they looked like me, like hippie-ish or whatever, but they had $10,000, $20,000 for a 8-month world tour or some shit. You know, so they were slowly going down their budget and calculating. So they would be on budget like I was, except for they were on relax mode, whereas I was always on stay alert and stay hyper and stay happy and always give positive energy to every single person you meet because people are the opportunity. When you have money, you don't need to do that. Yeah. So yes and no. People did do that, but not in the same way that I did. When I would meet somebody who's doing something like me, I would immediately feel a brotherhood. And those are the people that I still stay in touch with because we feel like we're similar souls. And you can't, you know, like if you grow up in a cult, immediately if you meet someone else from that same cult, you feel a familiarity that's like family right away. Mm-hmm. So there is that aspect to being a broke nomad. I mean, first of all, I felt very safe sleeping on streets, even though it almost never happened. I was on a street, but I knew that somehow I'm going to get a bed tonight, whatever it is, whether it's I go to a hostel and, you know, do a performance there, or I end up performing next to I go to some bar where there's a lot of people and I say, can I sing a few songs on stage? And then I collect tips afterwards. I was never for a second worried that, oh, what if I don't find a place to stay tonight? Like that fear wasn't there. And if I had That's those crazy. Kind of fears, I don't think I wouldn't done any of that. Like, yeah. I never thought about that, worried about that. In South Africa, yes, because it's a dangerous place. So I needed to make sure I was safe. But in Europe, in Thailand, in Australia, like, where am I going to sleep? When you don't worry about some stuff, I find this is superstitious, you can say, but when you know that it's going to work out and you don't for a second worry about it, it's usually the universe provides, you know.
That's cool. That's a brave way to think about it, man. I feel like a lot of the times I wish I had that in myself too, you know, where you have like all these this worry and this heaviness in the back of your head, what if. So, yeah, you must have had a pretty profound experience to be able to shed that. All right. So you eventually you said you came back to Korea because you kept getting called. Your friends were having weddings. Things were going on. How did you land a radio show? How did that happen?
Well, this is just a good segue without you realizing it. So Corona happened last year. If you travel, don't go to China or Korea. That was the thing. And people were calling me from around the world. Uncle, are you okay? You better get out of that country. You know, it was a thing. And so suddenly, you know, all announcements were in the subways everywhere. It felt like war. It was really weird. Hmm. Everyone's kind of in a state of panic. And it's true. Korea had the biggest outbreak first in a city called Daegu. And poof, it exploded. And what happens naturally is everyone in the world, anybody listening to me this now who is a musician or a performer or owns a bar, you know that that's it. Like you have to now think about how you're going to earn money because there's no more performances. All my shows got canceled. Everything was done. And luckily I had some money saved up. And then time kept going and nothing was happening. Corona wasn't getting solved, even though we all kind of thought a few months in, you know, we'll be back to normal. No, and my money was going down and down and down and down. And I was thinking, holy shit, this is pretty serious, right? But I don't know why. Even though looking at my financial situation back then, I should have been worried. But not for a second did I worry that, oh, what if I go broke and I have nowhere to sleep? Or like, not for a second did I think about that. I was, I don't know why. And yeah, I don't know. I guess I was concerned with other things. I guess I did have worries, but they weren't financial. Somehow in the back of my mind, I'm like, everything financially, I'll always be fine. I'll figure it out somehow there, you know? And right when I was at the edge of my finances, when things were dwindling down, around that time, I get a call from a radio show, I played a role as a guest a couple months prior. And, you know, you do musicians go on radio shows left and right to do just like a quick, you know, and it was one of those. I just did a quick thing for some show. And the one of the big guys, Big Shots, calls me. He goes, well, would you like to do a show on our radio? And I was just like, yeah, sure. You know, whatever. And I went and had the meeting and I understood during the meeting, like, oh. He wants me to have my own show, like me being the host of my own show. Oh, holy shit. This is an everyday thing. Like, you know, so my first response was like, oh, that means I can't leave the country.
You're locked down, man.
Yeah. So it was, you know, I guess I should have been like, oh, great. I have financial relief, whatever. But it was more like, this is going to.
COVID but didn't scare like, you, but a full-time job was, we felt trapped.
Because I didn't have a job since I was 21. Yeah. You know, I didn't have a boss or like, I just did whatever I wanted. Yeah. I guess I also have this kind of like, I'm kind of a yes man. I got to say, I'm kind of a yes man. Maybe too much so. I'm trying to be less and less of that, but I'm kind of a yes man. If opportunity comes up and it appears in my life, if it manifests, there's probably something there. Even though the result might be unexpected, either it's there because I attracted it into my life, or it's there for me to practice saying no to. Or you know, it's just simple-minded stuff. So this one just went for it. And I thought, you know, once COVID's over, you know, like I'm going to want to travel and stuff. And this probably radio thing, I don't know how long it's going to last, but I didn't realize, little did I know, that I was going to fall very deep in love with the job. I didn't know. The show was named after my name and it's called Uncoded. And it's every morning music show where I do exactly what I'm doing now. I have a mic just like this. And I just talk, introduce songs, talk about stories. We have a whole team that helps with what to talk about, the stories, the topics or whatever. And every day has a different, you know, segment. Guests appear. I interview people. It's never boring for me. I'm on air, it turns on. It's a live show. I get this little rush, almost like I'm performing. And then boom. And I just do me, except without swearing. You know?
are Korean swear words pretty fun? Are they, you got some good expressive ones?
All swear words are fun in every language. I think they're designed to feel good in your mouth. If you, the word, if depend, you can say, oh, I fucking love it. or you can say, I fucking love it. Feels different, right?
Yeah, it's
in,
got
in Korean, you can say, I, yeah, you can say in Korean, you can say, I, shibal sekya, or you can be like, I shibal sekya, oof, and you feel, you know, it just, it moves you.
Yeah.
In Portuguese, you can say, ah, fodas, or you can be like, oh, fodas caralupa, and it feels, you know? So yeah, there's delicious swear words, but the radio show is in English. It's an English radio show.
Oh, word. I didn't know that.
Yeah. It's all in English. It was designed for the foreigners in Korea. However, it turns out mostly our listeners are Koreans who want to practice their English.
Oh, that's really cool.
And that's a huge audience in Korea. Everyone wants to learn English here. So, yeah, quite a, we got a nice, you got a nice crowd, man. They text us every day and yeah, it's lovely.
That's cool. All right. So yeah. I'm gonna hit you with the lightning round. I'm gonna give you a couple questions here and you can give me your gut responses to them. If you could play guitar for any person alive or dead, who would you play guitar for?
My mom. She passed away last year. So yeah, that's the first thing that comes up to mind. I wanna sing her the song I wrote for her. Yeah, no doubt. That's probably the first thing. Yeah.
Is that a song that you play for people, or is that a, like a private
no.
song?
No.
Like when you bust, listen, do you play, man, that song?
No, when my manager for my company, my label, heard it, my previous label heard it, and he was like, he really loved it, and he was like, we should, because I made a demo of it, you know, and they played it in the funeral and stuff. So I wrote it because my Japanese mother basically had a stroke, and her whole body was paralyzed, and she was in bed and she couldn't move, and she was conscious, very conscious, but she couldn't move a muscle in her body. So she would communicate by like trying to blink or by yawning, or, you know, like then that's when you knew that she was awake and here with us, or her breath would get hyper when she'd get emotional. And so I wrote her a song then, like as soon as I found out that happened, I wrote a song and made it really like, I was in Thailand and I just made with all, whatever equipment I had, I wrote a song in Japanese, and this whatever I wanted to say to her, I wrote it and I made it, you know, audible. And so I went to flew to Japan within like a day or two, and visited her in the hospital, and she just looks like she's sleeping, you know, but she's not, she's there, she's fully there and awake. And so I gave her the headphones and I played her the demo, and she immediately started going, there's a part of the song that goes mama, and I say mama, and that's what I call her, and immediately she started breathing really hard and heavy, and the nurse was like telling me that that's, she's expressing that she really feels it. And so every time I went to visit her, I'd play her that song.
Wow.
And to me that's very sentimental. All the lyrics are basically stuff I want to say to her. It's nothing poetic, it's just, mom, this is what I want to say to you. And so it's personal. And so, yeah, later on I did a much nicer recording version of it. Like, and I had some friends help me out. Cellist and the violinist came and recorded in my studio in Korea. Made another, let's say, I still call it a demo. Yeah, when I write music, often, I don't know how to say this. Sometimes I write music for my shows, for my fans, for the audience, or for people in the street or whatever. And I perform them, and it's, yeah, it's cool. But sometimes I write it, sometimes, more often than not, I write a song for someone for a specific purpose, and then I'm done with it. I write it, they hear it, and then it's done. That I don't need to ever play or hear that song ever again. Like, I did this job. I think it comes from that, what we spoke about before, is like, don't go back to my past and bring it back up. And yeah, I guess there's a beauty to that and people want to hear it and cool. But like, there was that moment where the flower went poof and the song expressed itself, and then the flower has gone, and we can try to bring up pictures of that flower and I can, you know, redo it, but
it'll never be that moment.
It'll never be that moment. And so I'd rather sing about what's happening now.
Yeah. Even I dig that, bro.
Nothing's happening. You know, I'd rather, people always say, play us a song. And then I, you know, often on TV shows, I'd be like, play us a song. I'd be like, what song? you know, like one of your songs. And I was like, eh, a famous song, eh, like, and I just try to like make up something on the spot about what's going on. And it won't be as like a great melody, or it won't be a masterpiece, because it's just made up on the spot and it'll be clumsy. But to me, that feels like real, what I consider to be music.
It's for them. It's their moment that you share with them, that you create with them. Yeah.
And for them, that's a lot more sentimental than here's a song I practiced a billion times and I can do it really well. You know? Yeah.
It's a weird dynamic, right? Because people like the Rolling Stones, for example, I'm sure they're tired of playing the same songs for fucking 50, 60 years. But when people go to see them, they don't want to hear their new songs. They want to hear their old songs. And I think it's because music imprints itself on times of your life, things that you are feeling at certain times, you know? So when you hear those songs, you re-experience those moments of your life. You know, it's almost like a rebirth of that moment. So I think that's why people like to hear those songs. But I'm sure fucking Mick Jagger just must drink, you know, 8 fucking bottles of whiskey before he goes on stage and goes, fucking here we go again. You know what I mean? Such a strange dynamic, I'm sure. When I saw Bob Dylan, he didn't even sing his own songs. He got up there and he changed the musical melody of the songs. And he just went, literally like that, not even trying to sing. So I didn't even know what fucking songs he was singing. He did 12 songs like that. He didn't even look at the audience. He just played guitar looking away from the stage and left. And that was it. I could say I've seen him. I can't tell you what fucking songs he played, but I could say that I saw Bob Dylan. You know what I mean? So it's
wild. I love that. I don't think there's a correct way or wrong way to do music. Just because you're a musician, you're expected to be a recording artist. You're expected to, you know, release music and to perform songs, write music, whatever. Or you're expected to know jazz standards. You know, there's this stereotype of what a musician is. Everyone always asks me, Uncode, so when is your album coming out? I'm like, did I ever say I was going to release an album? Like,
they just expect it, huh?
I was like, yeah, but you have so many good songs. So I might, I'm not saying I won't, I might release some music, you know, in the future, but I've never felt like, oh, I want to record this and I want to release it. Like that's never really been a huge thing for me, even though I have released music. A piece of me that holds back is because I don't want the music that I'm making to become captured and then seen later. And because every time I perform it, it's relevant to now, to what I'm saying, to how I'm feeling now. But 5 years later, I can do the same song, but I would love to change the rhythm or the melody or whatever the vibe is in the room. You know, I would speed up the tempo or slow it down. It was always about what's the next performance and what do I want to prepare for that performance? And so I would imagine that stage or whatever stage that was planned. And I would imagine, you know, the size of the crowd or who I knew was going to be there. And I would construct my concert according to that. And that excited me. And that would... A lot of songs that I wrote because I had a gig and I needed to sing something. So I was like, for this one, a lot of songs were born because I had gigs and I preferred to write a song for that gig rather than play a song that I already had, or, you know, and some of them stuck really well and some songs work every time and I love them, especially ones that people sing along to. I love that shit. And it's no longer me performing on stage. Wow, Uncode, what a, you know, nice performance. It's not that anymore. It's, hey, we're all doing this together, and it's impossible for this song to have life without you screaming these lyrics at the top of your lungs. Let's go again and again. It's like a mantra. It's very much church-like, but there's so much power in that, where everyone is singing the same line again and again.
Yeah.
Oh man, just thinking about it, it's turning me on, man. Woo! It's been a while, bro.
I feel you. There's something special about that when you go to a concert and that song comes on, you know, like, and you just feel it. And like, that's why I love rap music so much, because when you go to a rap, you rap along with them. You know what I mean? Like, when I see Kendrick Lamar, I'm singing Kendrick Lamar with Kendrick Lamar. You know what I mean? And it's just such together feeling. Like, you feel like you're doing this thing, like you're karaokeing with the guy. You know what I mean? Like, it's a special feeling. All right. Next question. If you could talk to any famous philosopher or one person from each continent, who would you choose?
From each continent?
Yeah. So you can talk to one person from each continent or one famous philosopher.
Oh, so if it's one person from each continent, I have to pick 5 people.
No, so you five random strangers or one famous philosopher.
Oh,
you get to choose okay. one of the two.
Do I get to pick the philosopher?
You get to choose anybody.
Philosopher.
Who do you choose?
Put me on the spot.
Oh, yeah, it's the lightning round, man.
Jesus.
That's a good choice because I feel like people wrote books about him and he didn't write shit. So who knows what he really had to say? You know what I mean? All those red letters in the Bible were somebody's interpretation of what he said.
You know, they say that the greatest prophets never wrote a word. Jesus, Buddha, whatever. Mm-hmm. They spoke in ways that were relevant to their time, to their culture. Jesus used the word father because those were the words available to him at the time to describe what he's talking about. I don't necessarily, okay, whether Jesus existed or not, whatever, those words were written by someone at some point, right? So somebody said it. And whoever said it, and let's just, you know, go with the whole Jesus said it idea. When Jesus said it, I don't actually think that he thought there is one God, one Father that was up there that was watching him and that he was the chosen son of God. I don't believe that he believed that. He used those words because that was the only way people would understand what he's talking about or listen to him. You know?
Yeah.
And that was called, that's what was culturally available to him. That's all he had. If he had gone to India, if he was in India, he would have used different words. He would have said gods. He would have said, he would have spoken that way. He wouldn't have said your father. The word father, the idea of father, this monarchical, where's that word? Monarchical, monarchical. Anyway, this, the king of the universe. This idea that there's one king of the universe who's, you know, this is a very specific Western, you know, genre of religion.
Judeo-Christian religion, yeah.
Yeah.
It started with Judaism, right? With the one God deal.
I'm not going to try to be historically correct here. I don't know.
Yeah, I feel you. That is an interesting point, though. I never really thought about the language associated with the different people. But I remember reading.
Jesus, just, oh, sorry, yeah. Sorry, carry on.
I was going to say, I do remember reading a book that theorized that Jesus went to India during his teenage years. Because you know how the Bible stops at a certain point and then restarts when he's 33, when he starts his ministry. So I have read a book that theorizes that that's why his ideas were so radically different than the Jewish people, because he learned about Hinduism and Buddhism and then brought some of those ideas back. But who knows? Who fucking really knows?
I've heard that theory, and it makes sense if you think that that's the only way he could have had radical ideas is if he learned it from another country that had someone enlightened prior to him. Mm-hmm. Hey, it makes sense, but there are people today that just randomly wake up one day. You know, you hear the story of Eckhart Tolle. He just randomly, from depression overnight, just suddenly woke up and he realized that he is the entire universe. And he spent 6 months or 7 months or something on a bench just sitting there and watching the world go by. And it's possible that Jesus had some kind of experience like this and just didn't give a fuck anymore. He just watched the world go by for, you know, a decade or so. And then he came back to the society. He was like, you know what? I want to share this with people. Like, nobody knows what you guys don't realize that we are just one single consciousness pretending to be separate from each other. And that we are not actually characters, that this is just one godly loving thing. And once you see things that way, everything becomes love naturally. You guys don't realize it. And he probably had this desire out of love to share that. But I would love to ask him why he was so frustrated. Why were you frustrated, man? Like, because you know how he'd like, you know, flipped over at markets and he was
the money lenders and the Pharisees. Yeah.
Yeah. And sure. Like, I don't think people have this idea of enlightenment. Once someone's enlightened, they're in peace forever. Like, like you watch too many movies, you know. I do think that a person can reach this level of realization and they still experience anger and frustration and pain and all that. That stuff doesn't go away. That's an illusion. Suddenly everything is so peaceful. However, I think that things become very, very unserious. And so I want to ask Jesus, like, why? I mean, maybe did you just lose your temper there for a second and you just, you know, doing that? But like, yeah, sure, they were being ignorant and there was, you know, but why did you care that much? Why, you know, because I do believe he was a realized being, but at the same time, like, why did you give a fuck so much? And why did you even want to tell everybody that? Why did you want to, like, there's no point. You know, there's a, you know, the, have you heard of the Tao Te Ching?
Yeah.
So Lao Tzu, I believe, said this. He said, those who know do not speak, and those who speak do not know. Yet he said that.
Yeah, he spoke.
You know, so I guess in a way we can't help but speak. We want to share, you know, because as much as, you know, when we get to the point where we realize or at least get a glimpse of the inevitable reality that the ego is not real. There's no such thing as the ego. And this whole let's get rid of the ego is like the greatest ego trip in the world. Like once that happens, it comes with a big laughter.
Yeah.
And at that moment also comes this like need. Okay, well, I don't need to get rid of this ego. I'm going to pretend to be this ego and have fun with it because this is how the universe is expressing itself through this character called Ankhod or whatever. So there's not even a need to share it. You don't have to tell everybody. It feels like there's a group of people who realize this and a group of people who don't see it yet. And that's fine. That's part of the universe. It's people beautifully pretending to be important and serious and like, oh yeah, you've come off as a Christian. That's great. Like you believe that this lifetime is like the big test to decide whether you're going to be in hell or heaven for the rest of your life. Like you are the energy of the universe, just like I am. Forgetting itself into thinking that you're in this 80 years of test, like that must be really fucking intriguingly fun. Like there's no reason to tell everybody that, you know, the reality is this or, you know, no.
Yeah.
But we can't help but want to talk about it. I think that's why a lot of us, when we realize things, we just want to share it with everybody. And, you know, and I think, you know, Lao Tzu or Jesus or, you know, and you, I'm sure when you realize something, you want to share it with people.
I think that's the nature of human beings because we're all kind of the same thing. We're all kind of the same energy. Like you said, the universe experiencing itself. It's not just experiencing itself through Eris or through Ankhod. It's experiencing it through everybody. So I think that there's a very like natural urge to share with each other, to connect with each other. And there's something really great about bouncing ideas or, you know, philosophy or whatever off of other people and realizing and learning. It's such a good feeling, especially when you're having a couple beers and you're laughing and you're singing and you're being stupid. And sometimes somebody will say something so accidentally profound that it just completely resonates with you. And that's like the beauty of connecting with people. That's why I never bought like the idea of being a priest or being a monk or, you know, just kind of throwing everything away and just doing the same thing every day forever. To me, there's no beauty there. The same way that there's no beauty to me in imagining that there's a heaven or that nirvana is possible. To me, those things are foolish. They're just your brain, a way for your brain to say, well, I'm going to die one day. So this is what happens after. So let's just keep living, you know, don't kill yourself because, you're going to get this thing later. There's a treat down the road. So just keep going. To me, that's what those things are. Because even the idea of nirvana, like, so, you know, everyone thinks, oh, Christianity, whatever, that's so dumb. Let's go look over here at this other thing that looks less like us and is in a different language. Because this is where the truth is. It's not what I am. It's something else.
Exotic.
Yeah, it's exotic. Yeah. And then you study.
It's supposed to be exotic and weird and hidden. It's supposed to be like a treasure found in the Far East, you know?
Yeah, it can't be what I am. Because I understand all that. It's got to be something else.
Yeah.
But yeah, you learn about nirvana and you're like, okay, so at a certain point you have all these lives and then you figure everything out and then everything is great. But fucking then what? So, you know what I mean? Like the cycle of birth and death is over and now you're this ascended being. Then it's the same shit as heaven. Like it's the same nonsense. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I just feel like that's one of the big flaws of religion is that they think there's an ending. That they're like, you know what I mean? That they've created this formula. Anything that's formulaic like that to me is nonsense. That's human beings thinking we're smarter than the natural world.
There you go. Perfect. Because our method of thinking, our approach to thought itself is limited to the humanness in us. We make sense of the world around us through cause and effect. So you know, this came here because of this, and that came here because of that, and this happened because of that, and therefore this will happen in the future. This is such a useful thing that kind of separates us from animals in a big way, and what allowed us to create all of this. Not to say that not creating it would have been bad, but anyway, like it separates us in a huge way. So we think that therefore everything in life must have a cause and effect. I don't subscribe to that. I don't think there's a cause for anything or an effect for anything inherently. It's just all one blob of energy going, and it's never started. And it's never going to end. It's just going. A good example is the whole controversy of abortion. Right? You take abortion, you say, oh, you can't kill it. It's a living being. And it started as soon as, okay, well, you know, I find these arguments interesting because there's all these movements around it and laws being changed back and forth because of this, especially in Korea, it's a huge deal. And I don't have no answer. I don't have no answer, but I just have a bunch of questions, which is, well, so at what point is it considered murder? Is it considered murder as soon as the sperm touches the egg? Is that when life starts? Or is it, according to some people, when the heart starts beating or when the brain is formed or 3 weeks in, you know? And I understand that the popular one is as soon as the sperm touches the egg, because that's when the starts. But that's just how it appears. Like, why can't you say that as soon as you insert it while making love? You know, or as soon as the ejaculation happened, before the sperm hit the egg. So if you ejaculated in and the sperm didn't touch the egg, is that okay? What about using a condom? Isn't that like an abortion every single time? Or what about that, you know, what about that evil glim that you had in the eye of, you know, the evil glim that your father, you know, looked at your mother's eyes. And as soon as he decided, like, maybe that was you. That wasn't your fault. That was you. That was your evil glim. Like, when did you really begin? Like, when did you start? Yeah. You know, you can't. It's impossible to pinpoint it. It's only possible for us, our brains, to create these checkpoints. Like, oh, that's the beginning of this, and that's the ending of that, because it's a useful way to measure. Mm-hmm. Time is simply a measurement of movement. It's not a real thing. I don't think it's a thing. It's just, it's like inches. You know, minutes are like inches. It's just, we just measure movement with time, but there's no, we take it all so seriously, you know.
I can tell you the exact moment of when it's murder. When you're in a bar and this guy with dreadlocks comes up on stage and he plays you a song that he wrote for only that moment, and then you look at the girl you're with. Ankhod's the murderer, bro. He's the murderer.
There you go.
He created the moment.
And I look at her and I
yeah, it's crazy.
I don't want to. Abortion is a sensitive topic for many people, so I don't want it to look like we're completely, you know, taking a poke at it. But
No, I'm completely pro-choice, 100%. That's my, that's my personal point of view. As soon as I can make life, I'll have an opinion on it. That's
interesting.
That's
interesting. I have absolutely no opinion on abortion at all. I don't know where to begin. I don't have an opinion on vegetarianism either. I don't. It's like all these. Because I think morals are all man-made stuff. I believe that. It's just like, it's a whole topic, a whole level of conversation. It's just a matter of taste. How you want to live and how you want to agree with everyone around you to live is always going to be what everyone thinks is right. Not to say that it's all ridiculous, but like there's something to be said for just, let's just see things as they are for a second and, realize that we are deciding on the morals. Morals don't exist. Yeah. Rights don't exist. Nobody has rights for anything. Nobody's ever had rights. You just made that up. Who gives you rights? Nobody gives you rights. Where'd you get them from? You know, where can I get some rights? You know, and how can
America,
someone take away
a right?
That's where you get them from, right? Oh, I get them from God. And that's the end of the conversation.
My
God gave them to me.
Rights.
There's not, Yes. When did God give them to you? And why did God give you rights and not to other? Like, it's a never ending. They don't exist. Rights are a man-made concept that are very dangerous. It's helpful to some extent to give people freedom, but I think it's eventually flimsy, you know?
Yeah.
Freedom, I think, can come in a deeper sense from different ideas. Yo, I'm rambling. All these coffees worked.
I got you, brother. It's getting late over here. I'm gonna have to sign off. But yeah. Is there anything you'd like to say to the people as we wrap this up? Where they can find you? Any parting words? I don't know. You were very quiet this interview. So anything that you wanna say, brother?
No.
I want you to find him. He's AANCOD on COD on Instagram. He's a good man. He's an interesting man, and yeah, show him some love and just see what he's about. You don't have to follow him. You can just see what he's about. And then if you like it, if your heart tells you to, you can push that follow button.
Don't follow me, because then I'll get attached to you and you'll break my heart if you unfollow me. And I feel safer with less followers because there's less to lose.
All right, brother. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you.
You're fucking amazing, man. Thank you.
Have a good one.